homework assignment. Does anybody remember? John 11, okay. Lazarus, right? So let's, I'll call on a couple people here so you can tell us what you described as the challenge to faith in this chapter. Okay, so collect your thoughts for a second. John chapter 11, try to remember what you wrote down. First of all, what's the scenario? What's happening here? Lazarus dies. All right. So, what would you say is the challenge to faith here? Jacqueline, is it Jacqueline? Okay. Well, how'd you describe it? So it looks like the end, basically, for Lazarus, because they've lost hope of anything working out once he's dead. Yeah. What else would be challenging about it? Yeah, Tim.
What I noticed is that they had to been around before they know that Jesus did miracles because they called him Lord, so they believe in Jesus. Mm-hmm. But if you notice, just like Jesus, if you had been here, then this wouldn't happen. And it's funny because as I kept reading over, I noticed that when Jesus found out he was sick, he actually stayed a little bit mm-hmm. on purpose.
Yeah. Yep. And they knew that he could heal people when they were sick. So Mary and Martha knew that for sure, that if he would have arrived, then he could have healed him before he died. But then, so he could have been there, right? But he deliberately stayed away. They knew he was close enough to get there, but he actually went the opposite direction, right? So anything else about that? How would you, if you imagine yourself in that situation, yeah, what would be challenging? Yeah. So, yeah. So, does this remind you of Job at all? Where really it's the character of the Lord that is the issue, right? It's like, what kind of a person are you, Jesus, that you would deliberately not come when we needed you? You know, why did you stay away? Those kinds of questions. And you wonder about the character of the Lord, but at the same time, as it turns out, what happens? He actually had a greater purpose in mind that they couldn't really understand ahead of time, right? All right, so, yeah, those are all very good. What about, how did they, you know, what basis did they have for believing him then? In the outcome, obviously, he rises from the dead. But, yeah, on that side of things, what kind of comments do you have? Well, we have the challenge to faith and the basis for faith, right?
Right.
So.
It's funny, like, I got the sense that the disciples, they knew he was up to something, but they didn't quite know what.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly had faith, you know, from evidence in the past that he could, you know, heal Lazarus, but it's almost like there was a lack of faith that he would do something. It's almost like a question of his character rather than his ability.
Mm-hmm.
To me from that, so they're like, oh, you know, you could have saved him, but now he's gone. And it's almost like a lack of, I didn't even know how to put it, like, faith creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can God be creative in this moment, you know?
Yeah.
And
there's Job too, because like when you think of a limited way that God works, like he rewards righteousness and punishes wickedness, in that limited definition of God, you know, there's not room for other possibilities. Yeah, and so here, either Jesus comes and heals Lazarus or all is lost, but there's a possibility with what God can do that they weren't aware of, it seems like, yeah. So it's more like they believed in him, but they didn't understand.
Why?
Yeah. Yeah, right. It's kind of like when they say, Lord, we believe, but help my unbelief, or you know, things like that, where it's faith. One way of describing that whole scenario is being coming from a position of faith, but seeking understanding, right? So it's not that they don't trust, but yeah, it still would have been challenging. And I think it's the character issue that is the thing that comes up. Yeah, because God, in his, the fact that he's all-knowing, he would know Job's suffering and the suffering of Mary and Martha just as well as they know it themselves, right? Because we talked about how suffering is something that happens, that we experience as human beings more intensely because we're self-aware in the sense that we know what we're going through. But God, who has infinite knowledge, he knows that same thing as well as we do, even though, you know, he's not directly experiencing it. You know what I mean? Like, he has the compassion. So it's important. Anytime we think about suffering, I think that verse, the shortest verse in the New Testament, right? That right there is, it speaks so loud that here, Jesus, the Son of God, through whom the whole world was created, he weeps right as he's standing here on the earth with his people that he also created. So, yeah, remember that if you wonder about the character of God, it's not just that, oh, you know, hey, hold on, guys, you know, I've got a good plan here. Everything's fine. But he still, in spite of knowing that, the good outcome, he still weeps with those who weep. So, yeah, that's a great, great point. All right, well, let's do this. Let's have a little group activity on chapter 11. What I'd like you to do is get in little groups of maybe 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, just on the smaller side, and read through it together. Someone can read it. Someone read it, and then somebody, the rest of you guys, whoever's not reading it, try to write down the good things Zophar says that you agree with, that are something you can take with you and hold on to, the good things, and then try to point out, write down what's wrong, okay? And then we'll call on a few of you to come up and share that, all right? And then I'll just make a few comments on chapter 11, then move forward with Job, okay? We'll come back, try to do this in about 10 minutes, okay? Read through it. Write down the good things he says, the bad things he says, and be prepared to come up and share it. You have to actually talk to each other today. Here's a little image for you to see what's going on here.
All over the place. Some of my scans, some of my get off the internet, various websites. Like that. Yeah, some of them are, I think.
Job 11, guys, okay? Not John 11.
Thank you.
Okay, guys, 5 minutes. Try to focus for 5 more minutes.
It's like,
So let's have two people share some bad things that he says, some negative things that you cannot accept, and we'll have two people share some of the positive things. Okay. So we'll start with the positives, actually. All right. I'm randomly picking someone right now. Oh, how do you pronounce your name again?
Chavion.
All right. Can you come up? Or you can do it from right there if you can say it loud enough.
Do you want me to read two verses or just like?
Just share one thing. One thing that was positive that he says.
Well, he like through, I think it's like 6-11. Or 7-11. He talks about the character of God, and like that's good stuff. Yeah.
7-11.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's yeah. Also truth.
Yeah. Pretty much. All that, 7-11, you would say is true of God, right? His knowledge is infinite, and we can't find out fully the deep things of God. There's plenty of other cross-references for that, right? How the true wisdom of God surpasses knowledge. So that's certainly true, right? All right, anything else? Let's see, another random choice here. Lance.
Me? Good.
How about something different? Anything else? Sorry, this one's open for anybody. Anything positive that he says that you can't agree with?
Oh.
Yeah.
I like the line that says, "Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves." It's just talking about God's mercy.
All right. So here's Zophar saying, not only does Job not deserve what's happening to him, but he actually deserves worse than it's happening to him. Okay, so why do you agree with that?
Well, Job still sinned, so we still deserve death.
Okay, Job didn't sin, though.
Well, his sin didn't...
still a sinner.
This incident wasn't a result of his sin, but he still was a sinner as a whole.
Well, that's not what God says, though.
He's blameless.
What you got to do is this.
Is there a difference between blameless and sinless? I want to clarify that real quick. Job, is there a difference between those two?
Yeah, I think there is a difference between those two.
Okay, I'm getting a hint here that he was sinless.
Did Job have a sin nature? But, you got to focus on how this story is told. And where we don't want to go is saying Job was sinful. We just don't want to go there at all, because that does not fit the story of Job as the Holy Spirit has given to us. So, but there is, I'm trying to draw out why that's a good thing that you can agree with, because for all of us, we know that God has been merciful, right? Because one sin against an infinitely good and perfect God is an infinite sin. It's infinitely bad, basically, because it's a sin against a great God. So, therefore, it's true for us, right, that God has exacted of us less than our sin deserves. The very fact that we are breathing today shows us that, right, that God has been merciful in giving us life, and we don't deserve it. So yeah, I agree with you. I'm just trying to bring it out. So, yeah, we don't want to... I think we don't mess with the idea that, Job's a sinner, so, and all this stuff, because when Zophar is answering Job with these words, they're wrong. He's saying that, this is bad, you are being punished for sin, and in fact, the punishment is worse than your sin really is, too. So, yeah, that's good. Okay, how about negative? What do you reject that is said here? What do you reject? Random choice. All right, it's Josh, right? All right.
I would go with 13-19.
Okay.
It sounds like the appeasement theology that you've been talking about.
Yeah, so we would reject that, because how can Zophar know, in light of what we know from the story, how can Zophar know that if he does prepare his heart and he seeks God, that all of these blessings are going to come back to him, right? He doesn't have any guarantee that that's going to happen. He cannot assure Job that that is the case, because we know it wasn't because Job did anything bad that he lost everything. So if he does something good, there's no guarantee that he's going to get it all back. So yes, we cannot accept that. What else? Open it up to anybody for another thing. What else do you reject? Yeah.
Well, I would bring it back to verse 6 and kind of more in context. Zophar is kind of telling Job that the reason he's suffering is because of the sin that he's done. He's kind of like taking the self-righteous position of knowing why God is doing the things that he's doing to Job. And he says that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves, basically saying, like, you should be suffering more. Mm-hmm. And it's not true because...
Yeah, in his present tense, like, right now, God is, you know, his punishment is actually less. Right.
Yeah,
right now. Very good. So, since he's applying it to Job, that's where we can't accept that. Very good. All right. So, let's make a couple other comments real quick. I'll point out a couple things. Notice the progression. We had Eliphaz, who started very moderately. He affirmed the good aspects of Job's character. He was gentle. He even wondered, you know, if one ventures a word with you, could you handle even talking about this? Could you bear it? Eliphaz says that Job was near blameless. He gets close to saying he was blameless. Bildad, who's the next person, he says Job's children were judged for sin, right? He does come out and say that they were judged for sin. So he's going a little farther, and then Zophar finally comes along and says, God sees everything, and Job actually deserves worse than this. So it is punishment for sin, and in fact, he deserves worse. So he's quite tactless, isn't he? He's more blunt, and he's more direct than Bildad and Eliphaz were. In verse 2, he accuses Job of being, literally what it means is a man of lips. Some translations have a man full of talk, or, you know, a babbler, or something like that, but literally it's a man of lips. So put that image in your mind, a man of lips. So that's what he calls Job for the way he's talking. So he might have a different personality, or maybe he's more of an emotional person, but he's just laying it out there very bluntly to Job. In verse 4, he rebukes Job for defending his innocence and purity. And Job had done this, right? He had said, I am blameless. He said that in 9:21. And he said in 10:7 that you, Lord, know that I am not wicked. Okay, so he has been insisting on his blamelessness, right? And Zophar summarizes Job's stance as, my doctrine is pure and I am clean. He says that in verses 2 to 4. So that's true. Job had claimed that, but there's no problem with that because God himself had described Job that way. So, again, he says that Job is getting less than he deserves. And then he goes on in verses 7 to 12 and describes how unsearchable God is. And he's unfathomable and immeasurable in verses 7 to 9. In verses 10 to 12, he's the supreme administrator over all people. So this is all true, right? The knowledge of God is something we can't fully apprehend. But there's that prayer of Paul in Ephesians 3, 14 to 19. It talks about this knowledge of God. And it's a knowledge, or this knowledge of God actually surpasses knowledge, says. But we can actually have it through faith. So you can learn all you can about God and you won't be able to attain it all. But however, through faith in Christ, Paul actually says that it is possible to get that, something that surpasses knowledge and learning. So one of the things we have to do over and over again as we study Job is compare and contrast us and them, right? Because you think of the things they struggled with, and almost all of them, we're in a position that is so much different. Because we've seen God's work in Jesus. So I think hopefully it motivates you to thankfulness as far as what God has actually accomplished now. And thankfulness that we're not stuck in a time when revelation is so so small compared to what we've seen in Jesus, right? Okay, there's another chiasm in verse 14. Let me diagram this for you. These are all throughout the book of Job. Well, that is not working. A, B, C. C, B, A. Okay, so here's how it works. Verse 14, are you looking at it? If iniquity... I'll do the first half, and then I want you guys to fill in the second half, okay? B is in your hand. Remove it. Okay, so what happens in a chiasm? It reverses, right? Okay, so here's the main thing he's telling Job to do, reverse it. So what's the other statement of that?
Let not. Injustice.
Yep. Let not injustice dwell. Is that what yours says? Yeah. Let it not dwell, or let's see here. Let injustice
not dwell. So can you see how that's parallel to this? Actually, injustice is going to go down here. So, because injustice is actually same as iniquity, right? Okay. In your tents, right? Very good. All right, so get used to this, because at some point we'll have an assignment where you actually have to write a chiastic poem of some kind, okay? Just to make sure you get how it works. So, everybody got the hang of it? See how these two are parallel, and then it goes in steps? So you can look for those. Sometimes the English translation doesn't keep it lined up that way, but when you look at, you know, remember it's thought rhyme, so when you look at the concepts there, you can see how they're lined up. So, another interesting verse, we've seen this happen before with Bildad when he talked about the great wind, you know, that came, is how Zophar uses a word here in verse 15. He says, "Surely then you will lift up your face without blemish. You will be secure and will not fear." So can you believe the words that these guys choose in talking to Job? Job, whose face is disfigured with boils, he's saying you'll lift up your face without even a blemish. So he's... How heartless can the self-righteous be sometimes? It's amazing, isn't it? A person is just so sure that they're right, and this other person is suffering because they're wrong. They're willing to say things that are so hurtful. It's incredible. And then he issues a final warning to Job about the fate of wicked people in verse 20. He says, "But the eyes of the wicked will fail. All the way of escape will be lost to them, and their hope is to breathe their last." So he lays out all the prosperity that Job can have if he turns toward God and seeks him. And if he stops insisting on his own righteousness and innocence, he says, all this can be yours. You know, just stop insisting that you're innocent. Stop saying that. You know, admit that you're guilty, basically. And then here's all the great things that will happen. And then in the end he says, but if you don't, then the eyes of the wicked will fail. The way of escape will be lost to them. Their hope is to breathe their last. So, and that's where Job's been, right? He's been hoping for death, basically. And Zophar is aligning him with wicked people in that. Yeah.
I don't think you're wrong.
Oh, well, this probably should be. Notice I was going to talk a little bit louder. Yeah. Thankfully, we're not, like, recording this class for distance learning or anything, but in case somebody misses it, it is better. Okay, good. I thought you had some great point to share there, Chase. Do you want to try something anyway? Okay. All right. Okay, good. So, just a summary then. Zophar rebukes Job for boasting of his innocence. He takes major issue with that. He's saying Job should not say he's innocent. He wishes God would appear and show Job true wisdom. And he says that God's wisdom is beyond Job's comprehension, and Job cannot call God to account, and that Job should repent and be blessed. And there is a very clear example of appeasement theology, right? Admit you're guilty, even if it's a lie. Right, he's basically telling Job to lie about his innocence just to get the blessings back. So it's entirely satanic. Isn't it ironic also, one last thing on Zophar, that he talks about how no one can understand the depth of God's wisdom and how he works the world and everything like that, how he's immeasurable, unfathomable and all this, and yet he presumes to know exactly how God runs the world, punishing wickedness all the time, rewarding righteousness all the time. Again, he's just blinded by his own self-righteousness. Okay, now we're at chapter 12. And Job will respond to Zophar here. "Then Job answered and said, 'No doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you. But I have understanding as well as you. I'm not inferior to you. Who does not know such things as these? I am a laughingstock to my friends. I who called to God and he answered me. A just and blameless man am a laughingstock. In the thought of one who is at ease, there is contempt for misfortune. It is ready for those whose feet slip. The tents of robbers are at peace, and those who provoke God are secure, who bring their God in their hand. But ask the beasts, and they will teach you, the birds of the heavens, and they will tell you, or the bushes of the earth, and they will teach you, and the fish of the sea will declare to you, who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In his hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind. Does not the ear test words as the palate tastes food? Wisdom is with the aged and understanding in the length of days. With God are wisdom and might.
He has counsel and understanding. If he tears down, none can rebuild. If he shuts a man in, none can open. If he withholds the waters, they dry up. If he sends them out, they overwhelm the land. With him are strength and sound wisdom. The deceived and the deceiver are his. He leads counselors away stripped, and judges he makes fools. He looses the bonds of kings and binds a waistcloth on their hips. He leads priests away stripped and overthrows the mighty. He deprives of speech those who are trusted and takes away the discernment of the elders. He pours contempt on princes and loosens the belt of the strong. He uncovers the deep out of darkness and brings deep darkness to light. He makes nations great and he destroys them. He enlarges nations and leads them away. He takes away understanding from the chiefs of the people of the earth and makes them wander in a pathless waste. They grope in the dark without light, and he makes them stagger like a drunken man. So we know already that at the end of the book, God says that Job did speak of him that which was correct. We don't know for sure if he is saying that everything Job said about God during the whole book is, you know, God backs that up, right? But what do you think? What's Job's main point here, and is it true or false? What's the big thing that Job is saying? Right. And that does line up with his final declaration in chapter 42, right? That no purpose of God can be withheld from him. And he's saying, basically, he's broadening the definition of God, and he's expanding it beyond this whole punishment and rewards idea, the principle of retribution, right? His main point is that everything belongs to God. He's sovereign over everything. He brings to light and makes dark. All of it, the deceived and the deceiver, belong to God. God is over all. But he starts out with answering Zophar with sarcasm and the determination to appeal to God. He mocks their wisdom, the wisdom of the friends. He's heard from all three now at this point. He says that this wisdom they claim to have is common knowledge. He says, uses the phrase, "You are the people," which means you are the race of men. And the human race alone possesses wisdom. It's not something animals can have. And yet he says, even animals can tell you the things that you guys are telling me. So Job's friends have been saying that Job does not have wisdom, implying that he is less than human. But he reminds them, I also have a mind. So he's not accepting the way that they're reducing him to a subhuman level. He then rebukes them for making matters of common knowledge out to be some special knowledge, high-minded secrets known only by the elite. He gives them examples, just like, ask any old man and he can tell you these things. Even animals can teach you these things. And then he talks about the embarrassment he's felt as he's trusted God, right? He says, he's had conversations with God, it sounds like, but he says now he's humiliated. It's like it was all for nothing. He says, the righteous are humiliated while the wicked prosper. Can you see how verses 4 to 6 are examples of that? How it's not the case that righteous people always do well and wicked people don't. He says, righteous people are mocked by the wicked because it looks like their righteousness is pointless. Dishonest and wicked people were saying, what good is your righteousness now, Job? He can see, you know, other people treating him that way, that, you know, you thought you were so good and that yet here you are. What good is it to you now? But that's all fitting in with what Satan said too, right? If someone looks at Job and says, what good did it do you to be righteous? Well, that was exactly the question. Is his righteousness tied to his prosperity or not? Or is it disinterested? So one of Job's themes, again, we talk about these a lot, but one of them is that rewards do not always match behavior. And if there's one thing that's being proven, Job is bringing it across clearly, and the whole story teaches that rewards do not always match behavior at every moment. So he says very clearly in verses 9 to 10 that it's obvious that the hand of the Lord has done this. He's arguing that although everyone can recognize the principle of retribution, you know, everybody believes in that, but he's pointing out that there are exceptions in this world, many exceptions. So his big point, as you guys, as Daniel pointed out, and we recognize here, is that everything is in God's hand. God is over all. And that is true, isn't it? Matthew, the teaching of Jesus, Matthew 10, 29-31 says, not one sparrow falls to the ground without the Father's consent. Therefore, don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. So Jesus actually turns that into comfort, right? You think, is God responsible when a bird dies? Yeah, he is. He's over everything. Not one sparrow falls to the ground without the Father's consent, Jesus said. But yet there's comfort in that, knowing that you're never going to be outside of God's sovereign hand. Some people, again, question the character of God who would allow those kinds of things to happen, even animals dying. But I think that we can take it a different way, knowing that no matter what happens in this world, God is in control. So we don't want to sacrifice that because ultimately there's no security. At least, you know, some people choose to, again, you can choose to believe in a God who's not loving. And that's kind of where the atheists come down, is basically the God of the Bible, the Christian God of love, does not exist because no loving God would make a world like this. All right. Other people choose to sacrifice God's power, that he's not really in control of everything because he can't be. You know, people are free, the world is free, and so God really isn't in control after all. But you lose out on the comfort that's in sovereignty. And then, of course, the other option is that God doesn't know everything, and that relates to free choice as well. God can't know the outcome of free choices, but there again, you sacrifice something very great, don't you? Because there's no comfort in a God who doesn't know what's coming and who's unable to control the future. So we can't accept any one of those options. Job talks about his understanding of God in verses 13 to 25. He describes God as being in charge of the natural world. You see that in verses 13 to 15? That's what he's doing here, is he's describing how God is in charge of the natural world. Then in 16 to 22, he's in charge of human rulers, whether good or bad. Okay, so he's talking about God's sovereignty overall, over nature, over human rulers. And then finally, he's in charge of nations themselves, in verses 23 to 25. Are those backed up anywhere else in Scripture, those principles? Yeah, let's read a couple passages here. Romans 13 would be one. I read you Romans 13, 1 to 7. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. That's what Jesus said in John 19 as well. No authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. Okay, so what happens if rulers do bad? Do we have an obligation to obey them? According to that verse? Probably the best place to settle on that is that Romans 13:1-7 forbids a Christian's rebellion to government itself. So it rules out the possibility of us as Christians being anarchists. We have to recognize that human government is necessary, and God has appointed that because of the corruption of human nature, right? We need government just because of how we are. We're not good enough to rule to just do whatever we want all the time. You know, that's not going to work. However, it doesn't rule out any civil disobedience to immoral acts of government, right? So we don't say no government for us. You know, we say government is good, but if government does something immoral or commands us to do something immoral, then we have an obligation to actually be disobedient to that and obey God rather than men. Here's a little quote from John Stott. Whenever laws are enacted which contradict God's law, civil disobedience becomes a Christian duty. So you're actually obligated to obey God rather than men if the human government creates that incompatibility, right? So that's a little side note, but we're talking about how God is in charge of all nations, all rulers. He's sovereign over all. Again, that was John 19:11 and Romans 13:1-7. There's no authority except for from God. How about Proverbs 21:1? Let's see what that says. Proverbs 21:1. The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will. So God is sovereign over rulers. 1 Kings 12:12-24 is also another passage, an example of that. But let's go straight over to Psalm 47, verse 8. Psalm 47, verse 8, God reigns over the nations, God sits on his holy throne. And then for the New Testament, there's a couple passages in Acts. And again, just knowing that God is in charge helps our faith, doesn't it? We're trusting him with things even as great as nations. We don't have to bear all the burden of pressure to have those things under our control. Acts 3:13, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, the God of our fathers, glorified his servant Jesus, whom you delivered over and denied in the presence of Pilate when he had decided to release him. Okay? So he glorified Jesus, whom they delivered over and denied in the presence of Pilate. But then look at Acts 4:27-28. This is an important passage to compare here. So first, in the first passage, they bear the responsibility for crucifying Jesus. But at the same time, Acts 4:27-28. For truly in this city they were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. So God was still in control, despite the fact that they were bearing the responsibility for what they did to Jesus. So it assures us that the events of history are not outside of God's control, just like Job says. So God is over all, even the calamity that happens, and Job saying, my trial, this is from the Lord's hand. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back in 10 minutes.
Put the microphone on this time.
Okay. Let's get some volunteers here. Read some Job for us. Let's start off with chapter 13, verses 1 through 19. 13, 1 through 19, okay? Who wants to do that one? Next week? Mike?
Yeah.
So, all right. 13, 1 through 19, okay? 13, 1 through 19. Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Can you hear that? Do I need to, is that good? All right. Behold, my eye has seen all this. My ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you, but I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue my case with God. As for you, you withhold your lies. Worthless physicians are you all. Oh, that you would keep silent, and it would be your wisdom. Hear now my argument, and listen to the pleadings of my lips. Will you speak falsely for God and speak deceitfully for him? Will you show partiality toward him? Will you plead the case for God? Will it be well with you when he searches you out? Or can you deceive him as one deceives a man? He will surely rebuke you. If in secret you show partiality, will not his majesty terrify you and the dread of him fall upon you? Your maxims are proverbs of ashes. Your defense are defenses of clay. Let me have silence, and I will speak, and let come on me what may. Why should I take my flesh in my teeth and put my life in my hand? Though he slay me, I will hope in him, yet I will argue my ways to his face. This will be my salvation, that the godless shall not come before him. Keep listening to my words, and let my declaration be in your ears. Behold, I have prepared my case. I know that I shall be in the right. Who is there who will contend with me? For then I would be silent and die.
Very good. So with that section, we are hearing Job's reply toward the friends. And then from verse 20 on through chapter 14, he's really addressing it to God directly now. Okay, so let's talk about this section that Mike just read for us. He starts by sternly warning his counselors, right? He says, as for you, you whitewash with lies. Worthless physicians are you all? So he's warning them because they're speaking falsely, right? They're saying he's guilty when he knows that he isn't. So here's a picture of a whitewashed building. They're saying they're tidying things up on the outside, but on the inside are lies. Remind you of something Jesus said at all? He described the Pharisees this way: look great on the outside, but inside it was full of dead men's bones. So he rebukes them because they claimed to know more about him and his trial than he did. They were attempting to patch up and restore him, but their whitewash was lies. Okay, so that's the picture here, is that they're trying to patch things up and explain it, tidy it up on the outside, but what they're using to do that are lies, right? You get the image? So it's the plaster is made up of lies, basically. In verse 5, he says, if only you would keep silent, and it would be your wisdom. So the wisest thing they could say would be to shut up, basically. It's a kind of a contradiction in the statement there, but it kind of reminds you of what Mark Twain is known for saying: better to keep your mouth closed and be thought a fool than to open it and remove all doubt. That's a famous statement. But the best thing they did in their counsel was to be there and to just silently demonstrate that they cared about him. When they started talking and explaining things, that's where they began to go wrong. So obviously we need to be careful to think before we speak and sometimes avoid speaking at all. There's plenty of Proverbs that affirm that. Proverbs 12, verse 18, talks about remaining silent. 17:28 and 29:20. You guys can look those up if you like. But he begins to question his counselors in verses 6 to 12. He accuses them of partiality and deceit. He says that they're being partial to God, upholding their view of God, which is giving rewards and punishments, and that's kind of God's rule as far as they were concerned. But so they're taking God's side, but they're deceitful in doing it, because they're deceiving in the sense that they're saying Job is a sinner. He says their arguments are worthless. He's probably referring primarily to the sayings of the ancients in Bildad's speech, which Bildad's quoting all these ancient sayings, but they have no application for Job at all. And so they're worthless arguments that he's bringing from the other wise men of the past. And then he prepares to confront God, to take his argument to God in verses 13 and 19. We see him doing that. He's got a commitment in verse 15 that he's willing to die defending his innocence. Look at what he says here. Though he slay me, I will hope in him. Yet I will argue my ways to his face. And this is a very key statement, that he's willing to go through with this until death. He will hope in God, even if God kills him, but he insists on arguing his ways to God's face. So he's going to take his argument to God, and he will insist on doing so. He's not going to give in, stop arguing, accept his guilt, and just hope that God restores his fortunes. So can you see how important that stance is right there? They're trying to get him to appease God, and he refuses to do so. He's going to argue his case with God because he knows that it's the truth, or at least that what they're saying is not the truth. Okay? So he's going to wait right there for the Lord. And he tells his friends to listen closely to what he's about to say. Okay, so now he turns his argument toward God, verses 13, verse 20 to 14, 22. Who will read that for us? 13:20 to 14:22. Everyone is just jumping to do this. Not everyone at once here. Oh, Brandon's already up. It's okay. We'll let you do it, Brandon.
Only grant me two things, then I will not hide myself from your face. Withdraw your hand far from me, and let not dread of you terrify me. Then call, and I will answer, or let me speak, and you will reply to me. How many are my iniquities and my sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. Why do you hide your face and count me as your enemy? Will you frighten a driven leaf and pursue dry chaff? For you write bitter things against me, and make me inherit the iniquities of my youth. You put my feet in the stocks and watch all my paths, yet you set a limit for the soles of my feet. Man wastes away like a rotten thing, like a garment that is moth-eaten. Man who is born of a woman is few of days and full of trouble. He comes out like a flower and withers. He flees like a shadow and continues not. And do you open your eyes on such a one and bring me into judgment with you? Who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? There is not one. Since his days are determined, and the number of his months is with you, and you have appointed his limits that he cannot pass, Look away from him and leave him alone, for he may enjoy, like a hired hand, his day. For there is hope for a tree, if it be cut down, that it will sprout again, and that its shoots will not cease. Though its roots grow old in the earth, and its stumps die in the soil, yet at the scent of water it will bud and put out branches like a young plant. But a man dies and is laid low. Man breathes his last, and where he is, as waters fail from a lake, and a river wastes away and dries up, so a man lies down and rises not again, till the heavens are no more. He will not awake or be roused out of his sleep. Oh, that you may hide me in Sheol, that you would conceal me until your wrath be past, that you would appoint me a set time and remember me. If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my service I would wait till my renewal should come. You would call, and I would answer you. You would go long for the work of your hands. For then you would remember my steps, number my steps, and would not keep watch over my sin. My transgression would be sealed up in a bag, and you would cover over my iniquity. But the mountain falls and crumbles away, and the rock is removed from its place. The waters wear away the stones. The torrents wash away the soil of the earth. So you destroy the hope of man. You prevail forever against him, and he passes. You change his countenance and send him away. His sons come to honor, and he does not know it. They are brought low, and he perceives it not. He feels only the pain of his body, and he mourns only one.
So this is the last section of scripture we'll go over today. And this is Job addressing his argument to God. He said, I'll even die before I back off from doing this. So a little side note before we get into the real stuff. Verse 28, chapter 13, verse 28. Have you guys seen Nacho Libre in here? You guys seen the movie? Does anybody speak Spanish in this room? A few? Did you know that, you know, at the beginning when he's sitting there in the church pew, he's drawing the picture of his mask and everything like that? The priest that's preaching is actually preaching on this passage. And he's actually reading, it's in Spanish, but he's reading verse 28 and he's talking about it. Cruz, my little son, he was like, especially when he was two, he'd get up every morning really early and want to watch Nacho Libre before everybody else woke up. It was his favorite show, and he would copy the different things and, like, he'd crumple up his chips and put them on the ground and jump off the bed and go grab them. You know, if you guys have seen the movie, it's hilarious, but you should have seen him doing it. It was great. But I was watching it one day, and I'm like, I was thinking about the Spanish, because I grew up in Mexico, and I was like, that is Job. I couldn't believe it. So, but it sounds good. The poetry in the book, the words are just like, I don't know, like studying it up close like this sometimes, you lose it, just how amazing the poetry is. So that's a side note. The sermon in Spanish, look for it at the beginning of Nacho Libre, because I'm sure you're going to watch that every week of your life. So, okay, so here's Job's challenge to God. He presents his twofold demand. There's two demands. Number one, he wants God to take away his terrifying hand. And second, he wants God to show Job his sin. So he's been saying things about God as the watcher of mankind who's just coming up on Job and looking for some occasion against him, that he's, you know, Job's sure he's going to find something, but he's insisting that God take away this terrifying hand, stop oppressing him like this, and tell him where he's gone wrong. If God's going to find something wrong with him, then God needs to show him. So at this point, you have to say that Job was really seeing God only as an oppressor or a tyrant, and he wasn't sensing any comfort from God. He was believing that God was oppressing him, hedging him in, and drawing a line around him so he couldn't move, right? For Job at this point, being in God's presence meant pain and suffering. So he's arguing with God as his oppressor, not really seeking him and, you know, asking for more comfort from God. That's just not how he feels at this point. So he asks God to show him his sin. Look at chart number 5 on page 130 of your course guide. Let's go over sin in the Bible real quick. Sin in the Bible, chart 5, in the back of your course guide, page 130. Has everybody got it? All right. It's also in the teaching notes, I think. It's copied in there if you downloaded those. Okay, so God himself is a standard for right and wrong. That's an important thing. So if God tells us to do something, he's giving a command that's in keeping with his good nature. Because God, by definition, is good, and therefore what he tells us to do, those things are good too. Not just because God said so, but because he is good. And he says to do the things that are in keeping with his nature. So God himself is the standard for right and wrong. Sin is disobedience, unbelief, ignorance, usurped autonomy, that means self-rule, saying I'm in charge versus saying God's in charge, and the wicked deviation, violation, or perversion of God's will and law. So that's a really long definition of sin. But sin causes a breach of a right relationship with God. It creates division. It carries with it the disruption of a right relationship with others and the corruption of self. So there's three things that happen. There's a division between us and God. It alienates us from God because being good, God can't abide things that are bad and evil. They aren't in keeping with his nature. So it also disrupts relationships with other people. You've seen that happen, right? You know, you've seen the problems caused by a person who sins and hurts other people, causes a disruption in the relationships. And it also corrupts the person themselves, right? So that in itself is wrong because you're damaging and ruining God's creation. It is because of sin against God that there is sin against others and against oneself. So here's the Hebrew words, and this is why we're on the topic, because these words appear in Job. The three most common Hebrew words for sin are hata, which means to miss the mark. You've heard that pretty often, right? It's like shooting an arrow, and you're going for a target, but you let the arrow fly. This would be your action. All right, the arrow flying through the air is your actions. It's going to be good or bad. Either it hits the target, which is God's nature, basically. It keeps with God's nature. Or it misses the target and hits something else. So missing the mark, the sin is in what it hits, right? If it doesn't hit something that's in keeping with God's nature, then that is missing the mark. That is sin. Or falling short of the standard. Maybe you didn't shoot it far enough, and it falls short, hits something short of the standard of God. And then the parallel Greek term would be hamartano. The most common Greek word would be to miss the mark, to fail, or to be mistaken. All right, the next one, awa, would be to do wrong, to twist or pervert the standard, twist it to your own liking. And then adikeo is to violate a law or to do wrong. And then pesa is to revolt against the standard or to transgress. Whereas parabino in the Greek is to step to the side or deviate and transgress. So that would be like, here's the line you should be walking on, and you decide to go over here off the path. That would be the last two terms, to transgress off the path of how we ought to be walking. All right, and that carries with it problems in the relationship with God, other people, and the corruption of ourselves. Okay, so back to 13:27. Job says that God had drawn a boundary line that he's not allowed to cross. He said before God has hedged him in, but now he's talking about a boundary line. The line is drawn directly at his feet. So God says, you shall not cross, and it's right there. He can't go anywhere. That's how he feels. He feels completely trapped by what God has put him in. He describes God's dealings with people after that, on through 14, verse 6. Verse 4, it kind of talks about original sin in a way, right? It says, who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? There is not one. And this tells us something about the limitations that we live with in this world. There are certain things that we are powerless to do. And bringing a clean thing out of an unclean thing is one of them. Some people use this verse in systematic theology to talk about original sin, how if you have corrupt parents who have a sin nature, how can you bring a pure, you know, child without a sin nature out of that relationship? And some people would relate that to the fact that, you know, that Jesus' birth was exceptional. It was, you know, divine, immaculate conception and things like that. So, but primarily it's talking about the impossibility of some things for people. All right. He wonders if, since some people are destined to perish, why doesn't God leave them alone to enjoy these short and fleeting lives? Since God knows that man's days are short, why does God harass him like this? That's what he's saying. He says man's days are determined, and there's certainly a sense that is true, right? Hebrews 9:27 and 28 says, it is appointed unto man, it is appointed for man once to die, and after this, the judgment. So God does know the determination of a person's lifespan. He knows when your appointment with death is. But whereas Job is looking at this pessimistically, that God has determined each person's lifespan and determined the day of their death, so to speak, there's also hope for us because we can see that Christ had an appointment with death, that God had predetermined when that would happen. But that appointment with death of Jesus gave us the chance to enjoy eternity with him forever. So, and that's the other side of death. So death is not the end. And Job doesn't see that very clearly. And we'll see how there's flashes of light that kind of come through the clouds and give him that hope. You can see he's hoping for it, longing for it, but we have the full revelation of it in Jesus. So he starts wondering about life after death in 7 to 22. He says, "Unlike a tree that can grow again after it is cut down, there is no hope for a man to come back to life after death." So you see the comparison there? He's saying a tree, you can cut it down, there's a chance it can grow back. A person, death is the end. That's Job's perspective. He has no reason to believe that a person can come back to life after death. So let's look at a couple things on this here. Here's a little picture that I'll get back to in a second. So he seems to say that there is, in this present world, no evidence that a person can return to life. There were some other religions at this time that taught that that was a possibility. But really, Job is coming from the same standpoint of Ecclesiastes 9, 5 through 6, which is like, if a person dies, how shall he live again? All right. So they see, both of them in this wisdom literature, see death as the end for a person. They're not really aware most of the time that that there is such a thing as a resurrection. We get that revelation later on. But the resurrection itself is not a regrowth or a resuscitation. So it's not that a person, you know, just goes into the grave and comes back to life like Lazarus, right? The resurrection is something greater than that. It's a transformation into a new order of being. And, of course, that is, you know, not just the same body that, you know, Tom or anybody else is walking around in today. It still has that sin nature. It's a spirit-dominated body and one that is free from the sin nature. And so it's greater than just a resuscitation or a coming back to life or a regrowth. And you can read about that more in 1 Corinthians 15, okay? But he does catch a glimpse, it seems like, of the resurrection here. At least the thought occurs to him. He says, if the dead do rise again, he would hold on to his hope until his change or his renewal, his relief, his change comes. Look at this verse again, 14. 14 to 17. Let's read this passage. It's extremely important. If a man dies, shall he live again? He wonders. All the days of my service I would wait till my renewal should come. So if the answer is yes, that life after death is possible, then he would wait as long as it took in this trial. Do you see what he's saying? If he could believe that there was life after death, then he would keep on persevering through this trial forever till my renewal or my change should come. You would call and I would answer you. You would long for the work of your hands. So he recognizes himself as God's creation and he wants to be restored to that relationship with his creator. For then you would number my steps. You would not keep watch over my sin. So he's looking for a time when he has atonement, right, and a renewal, those things that he's longing for. So that's quite a passage, isn't it? He says, you would cover my iniquity. That's what atonement's all about, right? God covering our sin with the blood of Jesus. So again, does Job get the answer to this question here in the book? You see his longing, right? The things he's longing for, but does he know? Does anyone ever tell Job? Does God himself tell Job, you know, all this is going to be done for you? There is a resurrection. Your change is coming. There is atonement. You know, I will take care of your sin. He doesn't. And that's why in the next section, he kind of goes back into darkness again, so to speak. So, again, on 1 Corinthians 15, the change that is coming is like being clothed with righteousness in transformed bodies. And also in that passage, Paul says, right, if the dead do not rise, contrast this with Job, if the dead do not rise, then our faith is in vain. So if there's not a resurrection, then it is pointless to believe or to be a follower of Jesus. So what we're seeing here is just how important and how powerful the hope of the resurrection is, right? Job says he would wait all the days of his hard service if he just knew that this was possible, that God would atone for his sin and give him a renewal, life after death. I want to read you a little selection from a book. Has anyone ever heard of Alexander Solzhenitsyn? He was he's a great author, by the way, but he was a guy in Russia who was critical of Joseph Stalin, you know, the mass murderer. Then he was sent to Siberia to the labor camp for like 8 years and all kinds of stuff like that. But he eventually came to America and you know, was able to kind of tell his story, get his books published, whereas they were censored before. But he's got some great literature. But here's just a little short one. This one's from Stories and Prose Poems. And the reason I want to read this is just to talk about the power of hope. You know, when hope is there, what it means for a person. And remember, he's writing this because he's doing hard labor in Siberia in sub-zero temperatures most of the time. This is called The Elm Log. We were sawing firewood when we picked up an elm log and gave a cry of amazement. It was a full year since we had chopped down the trunk, dragged it along behind a tractor, and sawn it up into logs, which we had then thrown onto barges and wagons, rolled into stacks, and piled up on the ground. And yet, this elm log had still not given up. A fresh green shoot had sprouted from it with a promise of a thick leafy branch or even a whole new elm tree. We placed the log on the sawing horse as though on an executioner's block, but we could not bring ourselves to bite into it with our saw. How could we? That log cherished life as dearly as we did. Indeed, its urge to live was even stronger than ours. Sounds a lot like Job, doesn't it? Job said that a tree, you know, after it's cut down, it can actually regrow again. And he couldn't find that same hope. And it's interesting how Solzhenitsyn likens himself and compares himself to that kind of tree. But the truth is that there is good reason for such a hope, right? Because, again, Job didn't know it for sure, but we do in Jesus. There's another quote I want to share with you from D.L. Moody related to the hope of life after death. He said, "Some fine day or fine morning, you will see in the newspapers this headline, 'D.L. Moody is dead.' Don't you believe it," he said. "I shall be more alive that morning than ever before." And here's a person writing from the post-resurrection experience, right, which is where we're at. And that's the difference. So don't underestimate the meaningfulness and the hope that the resurrection gives us. We've seen it historically in Jesus. He's actually risen from the dead into a whole new kind of existence, and we're promised that we will share in that same thing, that he is the first fruits of our resurrection. So, you know, don't sell yourself short and act as if it's not a big deal, because it's the biggest deal in the world. That resurrection is coming for us. But again, with Job, the clouds of doubt and despair close in again, and we've got this amazing depiction, this amazing imagery of what it's like for him as he's losing hope. He despairs again because he believes that God is the only one who could give him hope beyond the grave, but God is against him. So he's looking to God for hope, but he sees God as his enemy. He now describes God as actively carrying a person to his or her meaningless doom and eroding this person's hope. Look at these verses 18 to 20. And what he's doing is comparing the erosion of mountains and the whole land in general with rain, that God sends rain on the earth and erodes it. And he says that's like what God is doing to his hope. He's eroding his hope. Look at the comparison. "But the mountain falls and crumbles away, and the rock is removed from its place." Isn't it amazing how entire rocks can be moved through erosion? You know, the whole Grand Canyon is a, you know, an amazing example. You got glaciers that cut through, you know, all kinds of things as well. "The waters wear away the stones, the torrents wash away the soil of the earth. So you destroy the hope of man. You prevail forever against him, and he passes. You change his countenance and send him away." So here's an erosion image, too, to kind of help us imagine. But this is the kind of thing that Job imagines God doing to his hope. So does he have a positive view of God here at this point? Not at all, right? This is what it's like in trials sometimes, is you don't, again, you're considering the evidence of what you see right now, and it looks bleak sometimes. So this is kind of like what's happening to his hope. God's sending these trials on him like rain on the earth, like floods, and they're just washing it away little by little. His hope is vanishing. So either God is sovereign in every detail of life, and history, or he's not really sovereign at all, right? It doesn't make sense to talk about God's sovereignty if he's not sovereign over calamity and evil, right, and suffering. Job asked the question, when a man dies, will he come back to life? And he said if there is a resurrection, then he would wait as long as it took, for any length of time. And, of course, Jesus provides the answer. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me, even if he dies, will live. Everyone who believes in me will never die. And then he asks the question, do you believe this? And I think that's the question for us to consider. We see how much it would have meant for Job. You know, and Jesus asks the people in his day, do you believe this? Because if you do believe that, it's going to make a tremendous difference in your life. So he proved this statement. He claimed to be the resurrection and life, and then he actually did it. 500 eyewitnesses on at least 11 different occasions saw him risen and transformed. So just remember, you know, that faith is not a culture, you know, that you're just a part of because you got Christian friends, Christian parents, Christian Bible college. You know, faith is a personal commitment. So when Jesus asked that question, let it ring in your ears and keep asking yourself, do you really believe this? That Jesus is the resurrection and the life. And hold fast to him. So what can we take with us from today? We talked about Zophar, first of all, and I've been reading a couple books on grace. You guys ever heard of Philip Yancey, Why Grace Changes Everything? Very good book. There's also a really cool visual edition, Why Grace Changes Everything. It kind of boils down and just takes several of the pages, but then puts them in there with pictures and stuff like that. It's a pretty neat book. But it really made me think about it, and since I'm also studying Job at the same time, there was something that kind of dawned on me, and it's this, that in Zophar's view, God's role is just to give rewards and punishments, basically, right? They leave room for the fact that it's not at every single moment, maybe, that a person's sins can be overlooked until finally the hammer falls, things like that. But basically, that's all God is there for. But when we come away from this whole section, I think the main thing is that God is over everything and that Job is giving us a greater view of God, that he's all sovereign. He's sovereign in every detail of life, even the bad stuff that happens. So there's two things. There's two things that we take away from it. The first one is that there is such a thing as suffering that is undeserved within the plan of God for this world, right? Zophar didn't have room for that. But Job does, because he knows the facts. So there is suffering. In fact, 1 Peter 4:19, this is a key verse for Job too, and correlating it, is that he says, let those who suffer according to the will of God entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. So it's a fact that some people do suffer according to the will of God. And so God wills those things in the sense that he decides that they should happen for some greater purpose. Okay, so there is suffering in the will of God, but there is also grace. So Zophar didn't have room for God to will suffering for a righteous person, and he also, though, didn't have room for grace either. So what was life like for Zophar? Doing good in order to get good stuff, afraid of doing bad lest he lose all of his good stuff. Do you see yourself living that way sometimes? You're like, oh, I better do the right thing because, you know, otherwise bad stuff will happen to me. And it's just not the right plane to be living on. You know, the higher plane is the plane where, yes, there's suffering, but there's also grace. So which would you choose? If you could choose Zophar's world, in which God gives punishments and rewards and basically nothing more, or you could choose a world of suffering that's unexplainable, that we don't always have the answers to, it's not necessarily deserved, but yet which God can turn around and use for good. And along with that world, we get grace, where God gives us things we don't deserve, rewards that we couldn't have ever earned. Which would you choose? I think it's obvious, right? But it was interesting for me to see Zophar's world versus the God's world, and the world that Job is really becoming aware of, the world of suffering and grace versus the world of reward and punishment. So I wonder, was Zophar's worship pure? Would he have passed Satan's test? Take away his good things, and would he curse God to his face? Probably not, right? His whole framework didn't allow for something like that. But Job, he's having his eyes open. And right now, as we look at him in chapter 14, there was a flash of revelation. He longs for something, but he just can't believe it. But as we move forward, it does get better for Job, and we know that God doesn't leave him on his own. He does come to him. So we're a little bit ahead of schedule here. However, let's talk about the homework for next week. I won't assign the poem this week, okay, guys? So you have a little more time to get your minds around how to do that. Oh, wait, yeah. We don't have class next week. I didn't need to mention that. So next week is Pastor's Wives for Monday and Tuesday. So there's no class at all Monday and Tuesday, but you will have class Wednesday morning. Yes.
Can we come Wednesday morning from home, or do we have to be here Tuesday night and sleep here?
I don't know about that. I think you should, if you just show up at, if you're, I think probably just sign out. Is there a sign-out sheet at your dorm or something like that? Probably, I would do that, probably, and leave it at that. That's correct. No morning chapel on Wednesday, just classes. So that's nice, too. There's not Thursday either? No. Yeah, there is morning chapel Thursday. Yeah. And I think missions class. Is anybody in missions in here? Okay, that's probably going to be on the lawn by the hot springs over there because they're having workshops. They're using a lot of the room still. The retreat's actually still here Wednesday morning, so. Is Axe on? It's not, because the sanctuary is being used. Where did you hear that from?
One of my roommates, Jason, I think, said that in
the... No, yeah, we thought that could work, but it's not. They're actually using the sanctuary. So if Axe is Wednesday morning, that's the one that'll go to the lawn, yeah. We don't have Sunday night chapel either. Yeah.
We do not?
I don't think so. Yeah. No Sunday night chapel, no class at all Monday and Tuesday, but you have no morning chapel Wednesday morning, but you do have class.
Why not class?
It's too complicated.
On Tuesday and Wednesday? Because they want to be able to volunteer. They're using a lot of the rooms, and they need volunteers for that. Okay, what else? So guys, the homework then, you have 2 weeks to complete it, basically. All right, if I were you, I'd go ahead and do it this week and then, you know, enjoy your freedom after that. Stay ahead of schedule that way. But here's what you'll do. It's you're familiar with how to do it now. It's just read the book of Job, 15 to 19, which is the five chapters we'll cover when we get back. We'll be getting into the second round of speeches and see how things move forward. But then do faith versus evil study number 3, which is you have two choices on this one. You can do Esther, or you can do Lamentations. So Lamentations, what you want to do is look into the fall of Judah and the captivity. So here's suffering that's happening. You know, what, you know, if you were in that group, people that were dragged off to Babylon, you know, what would you do with your faith? Is it all over? Is it worthless to keep worshiping God? Or, you know, what do you do at that point? How does it challenge your faith in God? And then Esther too. You know, there you have them in captivity. How do you describe that? So it's either Lamentations or Esther. And I would recommend on these things to use a Bible dictionary on your Bible software or in the library just to look up the background a little bit, you know, because these things happen in real history. So get into the history a little bit and explore and see if you can find out a little bit more about what's going on in these books. So you could just do, you know, pick up a Bible dictionary and look up Lamentations or use the Holman Bible Handbook in your Logos software. And just say, what's the background, historical background of this book? And the same thing with Esther. Yeah?
So for Esther and Lamentations, we're focusing on the chapter for the people in general, necessarily one person.
It could be anybody, but try to put yourself in the middle of that story and think about what your faith, how your faith would be challenged. Like, you know, in what way would you be tempted to doubt God or to stop worshiping God? And remember, it's either or. You don't have to do both of them. It's either or. So, any other questions on the homework? Again, I'll probably call on a few of you in class. Yeah.
Are we going to actually do all the papers?
We might, but I think we'll probably switch out a couple of them. Yeah. Were you thinking of working ahead, maybe? Yeah. Is anybody else? Would anybody else want to work ahead on those? All right. Yeah. There is actually. I think you can count on doing all of them on the sheet because we have like 10 weekly homework assignments and only 7 faith versus evils, right? So it leaves some room for some other things. So yeah, if you want to work ahead out, yeah, I think actually we can plan on doing all those. Yeah. What's that? If you want to, yeah. You can do them. They're going to be done according to those instructions. Just don't, you know, go deep with it and don't rush it too much, right? Any other announcements? Okay. Well, you guys got out a little bit early today. So let's pray. They've done it on Broadway a lot. It was a Pulitzer Prize winning play. There's movies like Creation. There's theme. Like, the theme is in a few movies. Like, that movie Creation about Charles Darwin. It's interesting because one of the... I thought about that movie when I was talking about Jesus and the sparrow that falls to the ground. Because one of the scenes in that that really disturbed him was, like, as he's working on his theory of evolution.
Thank you.
there's
the outcome of that?
The outcome is basically that the